I'm John Batchelor with my colleague, Colonel Jeff McCausland, CBS News, and the author, with colleagues, of a book that is Back to the Future, Tactical Nuclear Weapons and NATO, Once Upon a Time. Jeff, you and I have discussed this book because of the provocative language used by Vladimir Putin for a year and a half about forward-basing theater nuclear weapons in Belarus, perhaps also in Kaliningrad, the exclave on the Baltic Sea. But now there is a report that the U.S. is planning on basing theater weapons, theater nuclear weapons, likely gravity bombs, B-61s, refurbished, in the United Kingdom for the first time in 15 years. The question is this enough? Because there is also a concern in Moscow. Hey, what are you doing? How would you like us to... this is from a member of the Duma, but he didn't move without Moscow's permission. How would you like us to base theater weapons in Cuba, in Venezuela, Nicaragua, naming Nicaragua the first time in that list of rascals? So what we have here is nuclear weapons talk like the Cold War. Is there any difference, Jeff? Can you see a significant transformation of an understanding of theater weapons here in the 21st century compared to what you lived with in NATO in the 20th?
No, in many ways, it is back to the future, John, because what we're trying to do, once again, is create a ladder of escalation and weapons that compare on that ladder of escalation. And during the Cold War, in the book that I wrote, we talked about so-called tactical nuclear weapons, those being smaller nuclear weapons fired by artillery, short-range rockets, et cetera, that could directly influence the battlefield and operational maneuver. And then theater weapons, the B-61, which is married up with the F-35 U.S. aircraft, being ones that could be used in a theater context. And then last not least, strategic weapons, ICBMs, long-range bombers, or submarine-launched ballistic missiles. So what we're trying to do now is enhance our theater nuclear capability to deter the Russians from being able to threaten their use of theater weapons. And they have rattled that saber a number of times and expanded at least the possibility of doing so by returning weapons to Belarusian soil. Now, in all these cases, I think it's important to underscore that for the Russians, those weapons will remain under Russian control and not Belarusian control. They'll be Russian crewed, Russian manned, Russian protected. In our case, the ones going into Britain would be maintained solely for the delivery by U.S. F-35 aircraft. But even prior to that, John, even since the end of the Cold War, the United States has maintained several hundred of these same weapons in Europe, in Turkey, Italy, Germany, Belgium, and Holland. The difference being those weapons in those countries maintained under the control of U.S. forces, while at the same time on the airbase are local national, for example, German flight crews trained to deliver the weapon being transferred to them by a decision by the President of the United States in a time of crisis. So in many ways, we're going back to what we had in the past, creating a force structure that can reflect that same ladder of escalation, which once again, we believe is necessary.
There are no theater weapons or tactical weapons, to my knowledge, in the Pacific. Is that a shortfall on our part, given the build-out by the Chinese of their nuclear weapons?
There are a certain number of weapons we maintain on U.S. territory, but none on foreign territory. Now, interestingly enough, of course, last spring, the President of the United States hosted the President of South Korea, because a lot of South Koreans, even younger South Koreans, have argued one way to deter a threat from the North would be for South Korea to gain its own weapons, something we would prefer they not do. As a consequence, Mr. Biden and the President of South Korea negotiated the so-called Washington Declaration, which for the first time created a group, South Korean and U.S., to talk about the use of nuclear weapons in terms of deterrence and defense of the peninsula, number one. And number two, for the first time in many years, the South Koreans agreed to allow U.S. naval vessels to visit ports in South Korea, even though those particular naval vessels were armed with nuclear weapons, most notably U.S. submarine-launched ballistic missile submarines. And we have done that to once again enhance that particular deterrent.
The Houthis, the Iranian-backed Iraqi militias that killed three Americans, wounded many others at Tower 22, the threats in the Persian Gulf, we're told there's going to be a response. It is written by Admiral Stavridis, expect a 5 to 7 day campaign, expect going back to targets that were earlier hit, Now there's talk about hitting Iranian surrogates, walking it in towards the Persian Gulf. Does all that sound reasonable to you, Jeff? We have about a minute.
Absolutely, John. And not only Iranian surrogates, but I think Iranian interests across the region. To strike territory of Iran would be the most provocative and might elicit the quickest response and the possibility of escalation to a regional conflict. But that doesn't mean we can't strike Iranian Revolutionary Guard assets that are strung out from the border of Iran all the way to Lebanon as they move weapons, supplies, materiel all the way to support the Hezbollah in southern Lebanon. And so any of those assets in the region could be struck. We believe there is an Iranian ship operating in the Red Sea that may well be providing intel to the Houthis for their strikes against commercial shipping. One could focus on that. And of course, one can implement a wide array of weaponry, not only kinetic weaponry, but also cyber weaponry attacks against Iran to further the impact on Iran and hopefully deter attacks in future.
Colonel Jeff McCausland, United States Army retired and artilleryman, CBS News, visiting Professor Dickinson College, CEO, Diamond Six Leadership and Strategy. I'm John Batch.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.